The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast.
Professor Glenn Lowry is a Merton P. Stultz Professor of the Social Sciences at Brown University, the author of The Anatomy of Racial Inequality, the host of The Glenn Show at Blogging Heads TV, a quasi-member of the intellectual dark web. He is, at the very least, scheduled to sit on a panel with Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, and I believe Brett Weinstein in November. And he's a returning guest to this podcast. It's Wednesday, August 22nd, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. We've started a Zero Books reading group for our patrons at Patreon. It runs $15 a month on Patreon, and the first book on our list is Aslam Jape's The Writing on the Wall. Support us on Patreon and join the reading group to participate in an online discussion. That will be probably on Skype, but perhaps through Discord or some other chat app. All of our supporters get access to the Symptomatic Redness and alternative podcasts, and patrons who donate $5 a month or higher get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast as well, which means they get access to a second podcast every week. Patreon supporters are helping us continue to produce our YouTube channel and our other online projects like the Reading Group and the Online Capital Reading Group. The music you're listening to right now is the acid jazz group Free Speech 4. It's called Music. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Glenn Lowry and I discuss free speech, socialism, and the intellectual dark web. I'm really just glad that you're willing to be a quasi-surrogate for the intellectual dark web, or at least talk about them with me today.
Well, I'm willing to talk about them. I am amused, as I said, in my own discussion of this with people, that there's this phenomenon of the intellectual dark web. It interests and amuses me, you know, because it's a construct, and it's both self, you know, there are people who are like affirming it, and then there are people who are worried about it or commenting upon it or whatever. I mean, I
fall into that second category.
Indeed you do.
Yes. Just to be straight up and honest about it, I found that I make YouTube videos to promote our book imprint, and I found it's a very good way to get clicks on YouTube is to mention either Jordan Peterson or the intellectual dark web, and you will get clicks.
Well, that's a network phenomenon, right? I mean, they're going to be keywords and stuff like that. It's unclear exactly what it means, but again, it all interests me.
One way to, I think, understand the intellectual dark web, and maybe we can just jump in here.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, is to think of it as a reaction to a actual problem in society, that there's like a tendency to constrain the discourse today.
Yeah, I think there's a merit in that.
Yeah, so I wouldn't completely reject that notion myself. I do think that the reason the intellectual dark web is as popular as it's become is because other arenas, whether it's the mainstream news or universities or different online venues, they all seem to be very blinkered and ideologically constrained.
Yeah, I think the word is corruption.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask you, like, what do you think is behind, or what do you think the causes are for this blinkered moment that we're in? And is it new, or are we just noticing it now? Or what do you think?
I suppose there are many different currents. Certainly Trump doesn't help. I mean, you can't ignore that. But postmodernism. So, you know, that's my, I'm not a philosopher, Doug. I mean,
I know you're an economist, but I'm a Marxist. So I get confused about these categories.
Marxism. I agree with you about these people who are going after Marxism. I think they misuse it. And I think it's a kind of, you know, tag. It's just meant to say some kind of left thing that's been discredited. And I think that reveals ignorance. I agree with you. But I would, you know, point the finger at postmodernism and relativism and subjectivism and stuff like that. Not, you know, I would go in a different, maybe more psychological, than political direction.
Okay. But in 1994, you wrote a paper on political correctness that to me seems to have bearing today, that it explained some of the factors that can lead to groupthink and limit our understanding.
Right. We discussed that paper.
Yeah, we did. And so I'm kind of wanting to come back to it because it seems to me that you made a very good case for some of the economic reasons that people will form strong attachments to tribal identities and judge arguments based on their implications or what the arguments say about the person rather than what the merits of the arguments actually are in themselves. And I just wonder, I mean, you made that argument, you put that paper forward in 1994, which to me doesn't seem like that long ago, although I was half my age, you know, but it doesn't seem like a lot has been developed along those lines. Did you put that paper forward with the idea that just knowing the causes will help us overcome the problem, or what do you think the best approach is to try to overcome the dynamics or the incentives that get built up to keep people constrained?
Yeah. Oh, I like that question very much. So, I was, you know, impressed by the culture wars through the 80s, and, probably there was a lot of what we're calling political correctness today that was afoot. I gave examples in my paper. I did think, though, that the phenomenon, the reason why I'm so very proud of that paper is because I think, you know, it formalizes an insight about a phenomenon that's going to be very widespread. But I don't know if there's any insight in that paper about what's going on in the current moment, or for that matter, about identity and identity politics and stuff like that. And I don't know about the intellectual dark web. I was very impressed in being motivated to write that paper by what I was reading about the dissidents in Eastern Europe in the late communist era. And kind of emperor has no clothes, narratives that are institutionalized and kind of defended by structures of power that are at self-evident odds with the protean reality of daily life, you know, things like that.
The thing is that your analysis is sort of transhistorical. I mean, it seemed to speak to, I mean, I'm not sure if it's completely transhistorical, but it certainly seems to be something that's repeated in different historical moments, and the same dynamic can arise, you know, different points in history. And I think that what you talked about does have a bearing on identity politics, because it speaks to how having a political identity can limit your willingness to consider arguments. And I think that being, for instance, today, I think being considering yourself to be a person of color is a political identity. More than it is a cultural identity. I mean, it has some of those other things associated with it, but that's a political category. Or I think considering yourself to be working class is similar, that's a political identity. So these things shape what kinds of arguments that you're willing to consider, perhaps.
Okay. I think that's interesting. It's also psychological, right? What arguments you're willing to consider. You want to defend your political identity somehow. You don't want the dissonance associated with arguments that cut across it or cut contrary to what would appear to be its interest or something. I don't know. That's all kind of highfalutin theoretical there, Douglas.
Sorry. But you're the, wait a minute. Hold on. I've got a BA in philosophy from 1990. You're the university professor at Brown. So you're supposed to be the one that I accuse of being academic and not the opposite. But
I guess that's right.
Okay. But the reason I bring all this up is because it seems to me that we are in a moment where a lot of your rules or a lot of the insights you had in 94 are in effect and kind of visibly in effect and maybe in a new way because of the social media environment we're in. I'm one of these people that's very online. So I get exposed to pushback on comments all the time. And that, just to give you an example, the other day, have you heard about Avital Ronell and her sexual harassment?
Of course. Yes. That's such a juicy story. How do you miss that?
Right, exactly. So I commented that I thought that the people who were coming to her defense demonstrated that it was very difficult to come to anyone's defense in these kinds of moments without breaking some taboos, and that it was the case that Title IX investigations really are often kangaroo courts, that's not necessarily wrong, that because the accused doesn't get enough of an opportunity to defend themselves, and that these things are decided seemingly in a kind of through a process of gossip and media leaks and things like that. And the response I got was, you know, from some leftists was to just start attacking the imprint I work for, and to compare me to, an anti-Semite who was actually published by our imprint, before I started there, and just to dredge up as much dirt on me as the person could find. Rather than
dredging up dirt on you? OMG.
Right. Well, that was it. I mean, it was pointing to publication problems.
I agree that the connectivity and the communication technology and information technology exacerbates the phenomenon of hurting behavior, shaming behavior, signaling, virtue signaling behavior and things of this sort, which were related to the arguments that I was making in that old paper. And therefore, yes. And don't we see it everywhere? And aren't there more boycotts and demands for resignations and terminations from legitimacy? And aren't there witch hunts? Aren't we living in an era of heightened attention to the it's a Victorian, it's an ironically Victorian psychology, is it not? But it's not about sexual morals or something. But it's about this. Well, you say political. I mean, so anyway, I'm rambling, but it does seem something interesting is going on, Doug. I agree with that.
Yeah, and so we're on the same page there. And what I would point out is that, I guess what I was trying to point out in some of the questions I sent you was that while it appears to be a left-wing phenomenon, it seems to me to cross party lines more than we are aware of. And it also that a narrative has taken hold that it is, that the problem is coming from the left, that it's the left or the liberals who are censorious. But
it is.
Well, I mean, it's not exclusively the left or the liberals that are censorious. When I wade in to conservative spaces, I find I'm just as quickly boycotted and attacked as a person as I am on the left.
I think that's easily said, but I doubt that the data will bear it out. I haven't looked carefully, but my inclination would be quite the contrary.
Okay. So you think that if I were to go in, now admittedly, when I go in and I talk about Marx in these areas, I'm Stalin is brought to mind in their imagination, and all sorts of reactions are drummed up. And
I'm sure their minds are undoubtedly closed to, you know, the idea of socialism or Marxism or something like that. They will undoubtedly write it off as having been proven failed by history, will they not?
Well, that's something that's said, but that's an argument. But what I find is that people will also just start attacking me as a person.
Oh, I see.
And that kind of response is pretty typical on both sides. The difference is that when I go into a conservative space and someone starts calling me a commie or a degenerate or whatever they want to call me, it has no effect. That doesn't work because I don't care to be part of their tribe. So it isn't noticed as much when the people attacking you don't have any, I guess, cultural capital. So maybe it speaks to the dominance of the liberal discourse and the importance that liberal opinion has in our society, that it does seem to have an effect on, you know, the liberals' enemies. Like, conservatives do care what the liberals think of them.
But the liberals don't care what the conservatives think of them.
Right.
I'm trying to separate out the fact that the left controls organs of cultural communication like Hollywood or the media. I know these things could be disputed, but I don't think they could be effectively disputed. And is therefore kind of setting the agenda. I mean, there are all these excommunicative, like this use of the N-word. What is that? I say it with trepidation at this moment because the president is accused of having used it or something, and it will appear that I'm trying to defend him, and I'm not. I'm just saying, suppose someone did use the N-word. Suppose they did. What kind of witch hunt is this? That we therefore infer something profound about their character? I mean, that's hysterical. That kind of behavior is hysterical. This idea that you're so completely unfit that you can't practice your profession because you hit on somebody in the office? You shouldn't do it. But the penalty is death? You're now to be lumped in with sexual predators? It's ridiculous. It's absurd. No, I'm sorry. This is all coming from the left. People who are slow on the cultural uptake. They're not with the transgender thing. Okay? God damn it. I mean, not everybody has to be on the same page at the same moment. That's a lot of change. That's a lot of cultural change. You're so unforgiving of people not being on the same page that you're going to condemn them as bigots? Who gave you the authority to do that? The arrogance attendant to the way that the left presumes upon itself. I mean, I'm sorry. And on the race front, this stuff is completely out of control. The violence in Chicago, the way in which people talk about it, Rahm Emanuel can't mention family values, et cetera. I could go on a very, very long time about this.
Right. But okay.
No, so you don't see that on the right. I don't see anything like that happening on the right.
Well, right. Now you're at Brown and you're right. I mean, you're well entrenched in a liberal community.
And, well, I am at Brown.
Yeah. So
I also read the New York Times. What?
Right. Exactly. Which another is, you know, there is a whole bunch of people. There are a whole lot of people who do not care what the New York Times says. And if you mention the New York Times, you're almost as bad as I am. You're a commie. You know, I mean, that exists as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the point you're making is, I think, valid overall. Like, largely, I think it's true that the liberal side of American politics, especially cultural politics, has power in a way that the conservative side simply does not and hasn't for decades. You know, probably. Since the 80s, maybe. And maybe not even then.
What do you think, Douglas, the consequence of a major film star yelling "fuck Obama" would have been?
Oh,
it would have gone down in the annals of history.
I see
double standards everywhere. That's why no one will credit anything that these people are saying.
Right. Well, I think it would have mattered what the context was with Obama. If someone had stood up and said, I know we also are supposed to love Obama, but his drone policy is a continuation of the worst form of U.S. imperialism. Fuck Obama.
I think okay, that, I see your point, but.
And the same thing, the same thing is
my point, because if they had stood up at an award ceremony and said it, you know, they had stolen the microphone to say it.
I mean, didn't it was De Niro, right? Wasn't he talking about this, the zero tolerance policy and the.
Actually, I don't know the context. Perhaps I should back up on that.
Yeah.
I don't know what was said before he came to the crescendo.
Right. I think, in fact, that may be an instance where what you're talking about is a little bit of political correctness on the right, where you're saying, okay, look, this guy violated civil norms and we should, and the.
But that's just another, that's another thing. Okay. So, pardon me for making this point.
Yeah, go ahead.
Civil authority involves violence. Okay. I mean, the maintenance of order, policing, law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
How many children of Americans are separated from their parents forcibly by the imposition of law? Many hundreds of thousands.
More than that, right? I mean, I don't know.
Because there are 2 million people incarcerated.
Right. Well, okay. So, yeah.
I'm not defending this guy's policy about separate, you know, which is Jeff Sessions or whatever, about zero tolerance, about, you know, I'm not defending that. And it did have consequences that were very poorly handled. It was horrific. I mean, not only a public relations disaster, but a moral disaster. I concede all of that. There are limits to how you want to enforce the law and the extent to which you want to go and the consequences that you want to impose. And it could have been seen in advance that this couldn't stand. It should have never been done. I concede that without any equivocation. What I want to know is whether or not it's a hanging offense. Okay? And what I'm saying is evidently not, because we do it routinely. Okay? Now, if I wanted to go ethnic, I could talk about the rate at which African American children are separated from their parents. And I could observe that nobody has fallen on their sword about that.
Look, if you wanted to go on Twitter right now, and say, hey, white people, you're very upset about the separations at the border, but what about the separations in the black community because of the over-policing of blacks? It's another, you know, you would be celebrated like that.
I could go further, Doug. I could look at the disproportion of children who are in foster care. So we have children whose parents have, for one reason or another, disappeared from their lives, and they have to be cared for. I could look at the adoption practices, the racial premium on adoption based upon the relative supplies and demands of people who seek to incorporate children into their families. And to the extent that there's transracial adoption, the entailment of bringing children from other countries rather than availing oneself of the children who are actually Americans and raising into questions about the meaning of the national bonds and so forth and so on in such intimate way. I could talk about what you get for your egg. If you're a co-ed at one of these elite colleges, and how that varies with the color of your eyes and whether, you know, you're
sick. Yeah. And it's probably good liberal people I know some good liberal people who, you know, adopted a Chinese baby.
And God love them. I mean, one doesn't want to be understood to be criticizing their decision. I'm not doing that.
Right.
I'm just saying. These things are subtle and difficult moral problems, and they get appropriated to hijacked onto agendas and stuff.
Well, the problem with the – let's talk about family separation at the border. The difficulty there is stopping with the moral outrage rather than moving on to a political response even, let alone a philosophical response or a deeply political response. But It seems to me that we have these news cycles and moral outrage drives clicks and gets people's attention. And let's be honest. I mean, the Democrats have not stopped campaigning since Trump took office.
They have not done what?
Stopped campaigning. You know,
that's absolutely true, because they have nothing else, it would appear.
Right.
But I wanted to actually wax philosophical for just a moment, because not only are there political implications of this groupthink and this kind of boundary policing and whatnot that emerges, but there are also epistemic implications. I mean, you say, what arguments are you prepared to consider? And I'm saying how your understanding of the world can be distorted whole lines of inquiry, questions can't be raised and whatnot. So, for example, on this question about the border. So I think the fundamental question is about nationalism. I'm very interested in this because of the what I think is the kind of subtle and ironical, complicated intertwining of interests between blacks and Hispanics. On the labor market side, if you have a relatively less fettered inflow of relatively low-skilled, low-educated labor, that's just not good for the competitive labor that's the domestic labor that's roughly in the same niche in the labor market. I mean, there's just going to be downward pressure. There's just going to be more competition for jobs. There's just going to be less pressure on wages. There's just going to be – it's just not going to be good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's catastrophic. I'm not saying it shouldn't happen. I'm not saying it shouldn't happen. I'm saying it's just not going to be good. If your claim on the national conscience is a historical claim rooted in an American national narrative, see, this came up in this conflict between Gore Vidal and Norman Podhoretz, if I remember this correctly. Podhoretz was accused by Vidal in a very trenchant piece that was published somewhere, maybe in The Nation, that was thought to have been borderline anti-Semitic, that Podhoretz didn't understand the Civil War, okay? As I understand this, as I recall this, that in a way he had kind of just gotten off the boat or whatever, or that somehow as a son of immigrants or whatever, his participation in national conversation was somehow qualified or something like that. And what I'm saying here is, what's the black claim? What, you know, we got all these iconic things, Martin Luther King and, you know, the congressman from Atlanta is this iconic figure and we genuflect and we have this, you know, and it's all part of somehow kind of like a national narrative. No,
a national, like an American narrative, or a black nationalist.
I'm raising that question. I'm raising the question of whether that claim of African Americans isn't diluted in some way.
Well, we were going to talk about, and I needed to get a hold of a book about how the radical black left has ended up being nationalist.
Black nationalists.
Yeah, black nationalists, right.
Yeah, there's no place else to go, I guess. Huh?
And that's not something I'm prepared to really discuss it in depth, but I will say that the question of nationalism goes well beyond this question of how do you handle market pressures when you have more open borders and there's a movement of the working class across national borders. What do you do to if say you're a working class activist to protect the interest of the native workers. And it seems to, while not setting up a bigoted politics or even trying to necessarily, stymie the free movement of working people. Because by the way, that's another actual goal of the work, like a radical working class wants the working class to be able to move and to go where they like to find work. And so I would say that the, you know, kind of simple-minded answer to that kind of thing would be to say, yeah, anyone can come in and get a job and everyone in this country deserves a living wage, whatever, wherever they're from.
How did you construct all of these people to be in the same, quote, class? They're now all, quote, workers, close quote. Aren't these constructs? And does it expand to everybody who's on the planet? Is there any differentiation between being a human being and being a, quote, worker, close quote? I mean, I don't understand it. When there's such a variation across national borders and wealth and opportunity. People don't want to necessarily be where they are. People might, if they could choose freely, a lot of them would choose to be in places that are different than they are. The incumbent populations of those places understand that were those freely exercised choices acted upon, the consequences would be deleterious to them. They have an interest. I'm not saying they're legitimate interest. I'm just saying they have an interest in protecting what they understand to be the rents or super competitive returns that they're enjoying, attendant to whatever the complex historical and, you know, social causal forces are that are causing the variation in standard of living and extent of liberty and freedom of personal security and all the rest that varies across national borders. I mean, you can't just say everybody's in the same stew. I mean, I don't know where that comes from. That's such a radical move. It would appear to require an elaborate defense. But if I'm just pragmatic, if I just extrapolate from the historically given variation, okay, where then at the margin we're talking about making a law or policy, I don't see why I would construct the interest of African Americans in inner city America to that of Mexicans who might be living in a rural village in Mexico. They're not in the same stew. They're not just workers.
Well, I agree that they don't have the same immediate interests, right? But like they're not, and they're not, I definitely would agree that they're not just workers. But if you have a socialist vision, then what you're going to focus on first is the ways in which they're the same, not because you want to do that with everyone, but because they are the same in, or they might be anyway. They will be once the immigrants reach the United States and enter the labor market. Then they will be workers. I mean, maybe they're coming from subsistence farming in Mexico and now, you know, entering the labor market. But the point is that they're the same in so much as they have the same position within the economy. And that's what, you know, both sets them at odds with each other as they compete in the labor market, but also gives them the same kind of interests if you have a socialist vision of transcending class divisions and coming up with a different mode of production altogether. And also, even if you don't, even if you just think, okay, well, the working class broadly has similar interests because they're always going to be pushing for higher wages and trying to get a better share of the surplus and things like that. And better working conditions. So that's how you would lump them together. And you can see the other thing is that I would say that capitalism has created a world system already, that we don't really live in these contained communities, which have their own basis. We live in a global market, right? We live in global capitalism, and that it is a system that, despite cultural differences, has works by the same logic in different locations, and different things happen, but
okay. That's another, you know,
that's like a whole other podcast.
Global systems theory. Yeah. That's a whole nother conversation. Right. Intellectual dark web and,
but
the consequences of, closure and, group things.
Right. Well, it's the kind of conversation I would love to have more regularly with people on the right and people in the center, to be able to bring, ideas like, and maybe have them discredited. You know, I don't tend to think they would be, but I'm.
Well, I'm going to defend the conservative position for just a moment about nationalism and about nations.
Okay.
And the complexity of it that I see in the case of African Americans. And I understand black nationalism. I'm not unfamiliar with it. I would quote reject it, close quote, at the end of the day, but I do so, you know, and at some level reluctantly or something. Certainly I get it. But the more general point was going to be just like, if I make the extent of the political community more universal, I diminish the leverage for solving all of the collective action problems that governance entails. People want to avoid paying their taxes. They don't want to serve military and die for their country. They, they don't want to rally around any kind of corporate enterprise. They don't want to take care of themselves. How do I have a welfare state? This kind of thing. So mutuality, sense of mutuality of common purpose. Otherwise, we're in a Hobbesian world. Okay. So the very thickness of political community, which greases the wheels of action for common purpose, depends upon something. It shouldn't be taken for granted. It's a historical inheritance. It varies based upon historical experience. And these things of language and culture and of custom, and of, institution and tradition and whatnot. The shared myths and narratives that people elaborate. These are resources for common purpose, for being able to act effectively on behalf of common purpose. It's a pipe dream, this idea of global political community. It can't be. It's not feasible. You'd not be able to govern. It's outsized. So that has implications. That fact, what I take to be a kind of social theoretic fact, has implications. And one of those is, please don't throw away our national traditions unreflectively on behalf of some idealized, sophomoric, morality, which hasn't reckoned with the, inescapable, you know, consequences of, limited information and incentives and all the rest that make it hard to govern, any kind of a common purpose. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do see what you're getting at. And so I have a couple of responses. The first thing I hate to be such a cliched Marxist, but my first thought is, is to quote Marx and to say, you know, he said that, capitalism takes all that is sacred and makes it profane, and that, capitalism, you know, everything solid melts into thin air, under the capitalist system. And I would just say to you that you're not looking to the right culprit when you worry about the loss of tradition and community in today's world. It's not that there's a group of liberal intellectuals who are intentionally trying to discredit the notion of community. And in fact, you know, I interviewed Bill Ivey right before the election in 2016. Bill Ivey, who used to be the head of the National Endowment of the Arts and was good friends with John Podesta, and whose emails got published by WikiLeaks.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I talked to him about what he thought the Trump phenomenon was pointing to. And he said that he thought that we needed to return to sort of a civic politics and reengage with the notion of community and, you know, in terms of the arts, he was very interested in folk art and that kind of thing. And he also said, and this bugged me, that he was sympathetic to my Marxism and considered himself to be a kind of Marxist, only he didn't care about class and economics. Like, well, what the hell do you mean? You can't – don't say you're a Marxist. It just makes us look bad. But the point that I'm getting at here is that pretty much everyone misses the kind of feeling you have when you have a coherent community and an identity within that community. I mean, that's what churches are still doing for people in society. Even when people don't have a strong faith in God, they have a strong faith or try to develop a faith in their church community. And, you know, I don't know what to tell you, that capitalism is alienating, and it's, and, you know, there's an upside to it, which is that individuals are more free. There is mobility, social mobility and economic mobility, even amongst the working class. But yeah, we don't have, it's substituting for other forms of social coherence, the market relations and the kinds of production we have.
Okay. So do you go all the way to the idea that people's sense of national, pride or identity is an artifact of social and economic relations, that there's something that's, in some ontological sense, real about when people are transacting, when goods and services are being exchanged, when money is being made or, traded, in a way that, hand over the heart, misty-eyed sentiment of patriotism isn't real, is superstructural somehow. I mean, help me out here.
Yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, I definitely think that the market forces and the economy and the way we make the world and change the world productively, all that's very real. And I would say like ontologically real. And I would say that sentiments about the nation state or sentiments about particular cultural traditions are unreal to the extent to which they can no longer be lived materially. So church.
Do you think aesthetic judgments? So the nature of art. What is titillating? What is lifting the human soul? How do people distract themselves? Do you think that too is ultimately under the sway of material dynamics, that the seeking and making of a buck, the protecting of a prerogative associated with the greed of acquisition, that is the logic of capitalist sort of production dynamic, that crowds out the... That there's no independent, almost want to say human. Is it sentimental of me to think of a spirit that is in, that is somehow, acts, without, continuous reference to, the logic of gain? What about?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that, okay, that last question, I don't think I would agree with that. It's sentimental to think about or imagine a kind of world or to have a belief in values that aren't all economic. What I would say is that our intellect and our imagination are constrained by economic factors. So like, for instance, just to be real dumb about it, you know, if you go back 200, 300 years, the kinds of stories we might tell about what the future of humanity is going to be or what our place in the world is going to be, it would be very, very different based on our material and scientific understanding than they are today. So our culture is changed by our ability to change our relationship to the world and the ways in which we do that. Am I ducking?
No, you're not. I'm thinking about, you know, something that Cornel West might say about mass consumption and advertising and, you know, corporate control over environmental stuff. And, you know, so the very physical environment is shaped by, you know, this kind of behemoth, the sensibilities of people, you know, sneakers in the minds of kids in the inner city would be kind of an example of, you
know. Right. Well, I mean, there are different, there are easy ways to express your identity in today's society. And the, you know, it's not that easy for everyone because not everyone's equally endowed with cash. But one way to do it is through consuming things. And we shouldn't think that those things don't matter. You know, like the choice, the identity that you formulate through your consumer choices, is an identity. It's somewhat alienated one, maybe, but you know, to me, okay. Like I'm a big fan of Star Trek. I'll buy Star Trek shit, right? And I
buy the stuff.
I've got an ambivalent relationship to that being like, I wouldn't want to go around identifying all the time as a Trekkie or something, but it's not insignificant that I find that vision in that show compelling. So I don't know. I'm not. Maybe I'm derailing the conversation by bringing.
We're going to talk about the intellectual dark web, and I wanted to ask you what you thought about Caitlin Flanagan's Atlantic piece.
Is that the one about why the left is so afraid of
Jordan Peterson?
Peterson. Yeah. Well, I felt like it put forward a narrative that was only partially true and that the intellectual dark web was not as afraid of the left as the left is of them, but that there was a limit there as to what kinds of ideas they would take on and explore and who they would talk to. I mean, I have my own personal story with Jordan Peterson. It's not like we know each other, but I invited him onto the podcast, was told that he would come on, and then they canceled when he became more famous. And Then at that same moment, he started going around, or at least one time in a very prominent place on Joe Rogan's podcast. While I was in the middle of kind of trying to schedule him into the podcast, he said, Marxists don't want to talk to me. They never want to debate me. They don't invite me on Joe Rogan's podcast. Which set me off, right? And also gave me a great opportunity to start hounding him, to try to get him on the show. But I mean, I think Peterson's a really interesting character because on the one hand, he's actually politically naive. And, as far as his political engagement goes, I don't think it's very deep. I also think he's fairly reactionary and certain some of his influences are very reactionary. But I also think he's like the guy himself is sort of, benign character. Really, and he's, what is he primarily trying to talk about is people taking personal responsibility, people taking care of their own individual lives and the people around them, trying to not get caught up in these huge structures and figuring out who you are before you, go off into the world half cocked. I don't think that any of that is so terrible.
Oh, no, I thought I listened to it on the audiobook. Mm-hmm. 12 Rules was a pretty good book. As self-help books go, it was above the line for sure. And I get it. I mean, stand up straight with your shoulders back. I get it. Watch out who your friends are. Take care of yourself. Take responsibility. I think there is a...
But you know, that particular example, stand up straight with your shoulders back?
Yeah.
That's based on some studies that were done. That is at the center of the replication crisis. It's like one of these studies that was done that really can't be replicated, that isn't really found. It's like there was a study done that showed that people's attitude actually does markedly change and their abilities markedly change just based on how they stand in the world. It wasn't a metaphor, but it was like the literal like finding from, and then it turned out that probably wasn't the case and that there had been some, you know, monkey business with the data. So if you want to go, I mean,
yeah, I know it's not the other way around that you stand when you're, if your status in society is improved, then you are straighter standing in your posture.
Well, that might very well be true, but that wasn't the so-called findings of that study, if I remember it correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. In any case, you're saying that you don't entirely buy the Caitlin Flanagan argument that the left is going apoplectic about Jordan Peterson because they're vulnerable, because their ideas are bankrupt, because they don't have any answers. He's threatening to them. He can't be right. He has to be wrong.
I would say two things to that. First of all, you know that not all men, ideas, I was not all leftists. I consider myself part of the left and I'm not afraid to debate these ideas. And the second thing I would say is that the left is part of this culture, and the fact that the left is as fucked up as it is, that it's having such difficulty in so many different arenas, is a sign that we as a culture are not able to get past some of the problems we have. Because I think the left is the best chance for solving some of the innate difficulties and contradictions within, I'll say it, the bourgeois capitalist society, and that, we can't, if the left can't take up the challenge of actually being radical, which would include arguing strongly for your position and thinking things through deeply, but only reacts morally and sort of, culturally. Then, yeah, we've got a real crisis, but it's not just a crisis of this isolated left. It's a crisis of the overall society.
I wonder if it isn't a manufactured crisis. I wonder if this sense of constant, unending struggle isn't a kind of Manichaean vision. I mean, isn't it? And maybe it imputes way too much importance to us. We're going to set things right. We're going to make the world right and fit I wonder about that. I think about that in the context of the climate change debate, for example, and people are going to call me a denier. I'm not a denier. I'm not a denier whatsoever. It's just that I see it playing out the way I see it playing out. It's like, you know, there's stuff that we don't actually have control over. For all I know, and please forgive the ignorance of this because I'm not a geoscientist, I'm not. For all I know, changes in the patterns of weather on the sun, I'm talking about sunspots and flares. For all I know, could have, massively consequential, implications for, the ecology and whatnot of the various, organisms that are alive on this planet. For all I know, man-made climate change might, at the end of historical time, prove to be of relatively little significance. I know that's a horrible thing to say amidst the enthusiasm. But the enthusiasm interests me because it's a way of being on the right side of history. It's a way of channeling my desire to make the world a better place. I have a cause now on behalf of which to devote myself. There are heroes and there are villains. And I wonder, whether or not class struggle at the end of the day, I mean to be challenging you, Doug, is the world historic force, the font of human meaning, the master narrative of historical evolution. I wonder about that. It's not self-evident to me. I mean, and that's why I'm not a Marxist.
Right. Well, okay. Can I tackle the climate change thing first and then?
Yeah.
Okay. So the climate change issue, I'm old enough now to remember when, this first sort of came on the scene. Maybe not exactly when it actually originated, but in the early 90s, it was certainly a very big question and problem. And I recall that I was part of the environmental movement then. I was working for a PIRG in my early 20s. And that's a public interest research group in Oregon. And so I was working for Osberg, and the people around me were very discouraged and upset, first by Bush Sr., but then by the Clinton administration, neither of which seemed prepared to do what was necessary to actually address the looming threat that climate change seemed to suggest was on the horizon. And I had friends. I knew a guy then who sold pot for a living, and at that point it was illegal.
Yeah.
So I knew a pot dealer who was telling me that within 20 years, the whole earth would be fried. And, he was not as wrong as maybe, I mean, it's been pretty hot lately, but, what I thought at the time was that, and what I think now is that no one's really prepared to do what is supposedly necessary to really address the climate change. And that instead, like, for instance, when Al Gore, started to really speak out about this was the moment he no longer had any political power to do anything about it. Why was he not, when he was actually, in the White House, when he was the vice president, why was he not leading the conversation then about making changes? And I think there were lots of reasons why. I think the political solutions constrained. Anyway, go ahead.
I mean, let me just say, I think it's easy to overstate the effectiveness of any particular action. I don't know what it might be about power plants or whatever. I understand it's going to have a hit on the CO2 emissions, or whether it's fuel standards for vehicles or whatever. I think it's easy to, you say do something about it, and do something about it involves a long slog. It involves a lot of stuff. And I wonder why we don't ever go to the question of lifestyle in a more fundamental way than we do. We titter around the edges of it. The idea that I should get on a plane and fly from one side of the continent to the other routinely without reflection. Maybe that's something that I should only do a half dozen times in my entire life. There's teleconferencing. No, I'm saying, what does it mean for hundreds of billions of Chinese and Indian peasants to come online, to live in apartments, to have air conditioning, refrigeration, to have vehicles, to want to fly from one side of the continent to another. What does it mean? That our definition of modern, developed, successful way of life entails the prerogative to all of these things that are massively, look at the distribution and space of our economic activity. There should be some areas of climate where, because you have to have an air conditioner running all the time, people shouldn't even be there. I mean, but they're there. They're going to be there. So it's like the state, if the stakes were really as high as people are saying, the issue of who's president of the United States would be a secondary issue. The primary issue would be whether or not we're all going to become ascetics on behalf of a preservation of not just human life, but of the global, organic system. I mean, I feel like a lot of it is ideology. It's religion. It's anti-capitalist.
Listen, I have my own religion. Yes, but and my religion is sort of, and Marxists will call me out on this, but I have this sort of religion of reason, right? Like, and I actually believe that the aim of socialism should be to create a society in which rationality and reason can be collectively held and can actually shape our future. And that's a very frightening prospect to a lot of people, because it doesn't have a great track record. The people who've stood up in the name of rationality and reason have done some horrific things. But nonetheless, that's what I would think we should be trying to aim at, is to have human capacity really fully activated and give us the power that would then set up a society where we would have the power to really react rationally to problems such as climate change. But right now, the reason why people are still moving to areas where it doesn't make ecological sense for them to live is because it makes market sense for them to live. There's a force in the world that is alien to us, that is more important than we are, that is directing our lives. And that the aim of socialism is to have human society itself be self-reflective and able to direct itself, rather than have some externality in play that will.
Okay, that's a compelling argument for socialism. I want to offer a critique. Okay. So on the one hand, there's property. Okay, so this compelling system that you talk about, which you want not to just be running willy-nilly, but you want it to be under the sort of communal and conscious, if you will, rational administration of the state or of the people acting collectively. This thing is built in some sense or another on some idea about property, about ownership, which is what, you know, the legitimacy of the control over these things, land, natural resources, the labor power of human beings, financial capital, the all of these artifacts that get created through and accumulated. And then they have to be owned, because there's some system of, you know, how you administer the rights of usage of the various assets and processes that are extant in society. And those things ultimately involve power. I mean, people talk about socialism as independently, or I'm sorry, not to say that you are doing so, Doug. I await your further elaboration. Independently of reckoning with the fact that the various edicts, commands, that are allocating and reallocating, are carried out on pain of force. Otherwise people are not necessarily going to cooperate. There's gotta be a Huskow somewhere. There's gotta be a gendarme somewhere. And the legitimacy of the exercise of that force, the accountability of the exercise of that force, the capacity to revise, the extent to which people's voices are heard in reference to such forces as are applied to themselves and to the things that they own and produce with their own hand. So I need a prior theory, don't I? Who owns what? Who has the right to what? Who's entitled to do what to whom else? This kind of thing. I can't just imagine that I'm going to, you know, rein in the capacious, rapacious, consequences of unfettered capitalism as if the alternative wasn't in its own way at risk of becoming unfettered. And don't we have ample historical example of that?
Yeah. Well, I would say, first of all, that I am not someone who looks to the state management of capitalism as the end goal of socialism. That the way I understand socialism is that it would mean transforming the basis of the production of society. So you would no longer have, you know, workers who came to work for a wage, who sold their labor power and so on and so forth. There's a whole theory, you know, I've read Capital Volume 1 and so on and so forth. But to make it clear what I'm talking about, as I'd say this, you, in order to understand how authority is functioning today and how it might help us develop a more humane kind of authority in the future, we should look to what is good about capitalism. What is good about capitalism is that it doesn't actually truly come down to the power of a gun or to the power of violence. If it did, society would not function. It would completely break apart. The truth of any society is that it relies on cooperation much more than force. I mean, that the force may be in the background, but if it's the moment it comes into the foreground, then you have crisis. And to the degree to which you need it in the foreground for society to function, is the degree to which your society is going to completely crack up. That's just not how people are. And so what's good about capitalism is that it brings a lot of people together to cooperate and be incredibly productive, in a way that seems, on the surface at least, to be cooperative and fair. There are ways in which it isn't, but it isn't primarily a violent system of organizing. The violence is a developed, you know, comes out of it, but isn't what makes it go.
But that's very friendly to Adam Smith, that.
Yeah, right. What I would say is I'm with Adam Smith. There is an invisible hand of the market. The problem is there's also like an invisible foot that comes along and kicks you in your ass after you got going for a while. And I want to develop a society where we can change the mode of production, change the kind of system that we have that's making the world work, and keep an eye on it. See when there's that invisible foot and have major changes or modifications as necessary. But I think it starts with worker control and transformation of daily life and daily production. But I don't know. I mean, at that point, you start to get into the realm of like inter-Marxist debate as to what socialism is and how we should conceive of it. And what I would love to have is all the best minds thinking about that rather than debating whether or not we should stay within capitalism or how to. We don't even debate whether we should. We just debate how to manage what's obviously a broken system.
And the political theory of how this becomes a reality of how the forces that are in control of the order that we're embedded in are so reconfigured. Does that enter in? Is that a different kind of study than the idealized study of what the ideal socialist society should look like, the transition study or the study of revolution?
It depends on who you're talking to in the Marxist left. I mean, I think a lot of the Marxist left has a history of thinking that the political struggle is the same thing as the struggle to develop socialism, and that the first step is taking power, seizing the state, creating that dictatorship of the proletariat, and then the working class will magically sort of come up with the new society for you. And I'm not in that camp.
I think this accounts for why I'm a conservative. I've been reading Roger Scruton's book on conservatism. Scruton, you know, is the British philosopher. Who's written, he's a big guy, written huge books about aesthetics and about the history of philosophy and whatever. I'm not a philosopher, but he was my colleague for some years when I was at Boston University.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was in the university professors program there, and I got to meet some of these. I got to meet and got to know Saul Bellow, for example.
Oh, wow. In
his life. Yeah, that was a special experience.
I like Saul Bellow. I'm not such a huge fan of Roger Scruton, but anyhow.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's a Tory. I mean, I wouldn't have expected you, my Marxist friend, to be a huge fan of him. But the point I'm trying to make is he's doing this kind of tour de force review of the kind of foundations of conservatism and whatnot. He's on Edmund Burke. You know, he's talking about the French Revolution and whatnot. And I'm just made to think about how radical is this idea of revolution, of revolutionary transformation, of, you know, sort of rationalizing and reckoning historical forces according to some system, and then in an ordered way bending human relations or social political relations on this way rather than that on behalf of this vision. And it entails a whole lot of supposition about knowing, about how we know things and how we come to know things. And this idea that, you know, so in Burke, as I understand it, this is secondhand from Scruton. I haven't actually read. I have to confess, my education is not complete, Douglas. I haven't read Edmund Burke in the.
I haven't either. I have a copy of one of his books on my bookshelf, but it was forced into my hand by a conservative friend of mine. And I never picked up, so I should read Edmund Burke.
So the idea, as I understand it, is what is a more reliable foundation, reason or custom? Okay? And I mean, I see this, you know, in this kind of hyper-rational, you know, I mean, of this enlightenment and this modernity and you know, and I mean, you could see it in Kant. Again, I'm not a philosopher, but you can see this kind of idea that we're going to invent from first principles. We're going to, you know. Everything is going to be according to an axiomatic deduction versus this kind of accretion of customary inheritance of congealed wisdom over the ages of blah, 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 blah. And with respect to authority, okay, so in the extreme, authority over the life and death of people. They're ending up at the guillotine, you know. And the legitimacy of the exercise of this awesome authority of state power, of centralized state power, that it would be accepted by the people as being legitimate. What does that rest upon? Mucking around with, you know, I reveal how conservative I am about religion. Okay. So we can outthink our forefathers and forebears. I mean, not that we don't know more than they do. Of course, we stand post-enlightenment. We know a good deal more than they do. But what do we know about the human soul? I want to say, and then I will be dismissed. What do we know about the darkness of the human soul? I will want to say, and I will be dismissed. I will be dismissed. And yet, you know, so all the precepts, all the limitations and boundaries, all of the taboos, are they to be thrown over? And replaced by what? By what we can deduce from what?
Glenn, I'm so pleased with how this conversation has gone. You have no idea. Because, first of all, I love the last question you asked, because that brings us right back to the intellectual dark web. Only now you're asking it to me, the leftist, whereas up before the leftist was asking it of the intellectual dark web. How many taboos are we going to be willing to throw over? What, are we to really believe in reason rather than custom? You know, that's the whole thrust of the intellectual dark web is that it rests on free speech. It rests on free inquiry. It says we have to risk breaking taboos and think deeply about things. And that means they have to have there must be in there some sort of faith and rationality and reason, some sort of initial, axiomatic, conclusion that, you know, a presupposition that reason is the way we develop knowledge rather than through some other secret, mystical, occult approach.
So let's talk about a concrete illustration.
Well, I want to say one thing about Jordan Peterson, which is
yes, go before, on.
Okay, which is just that this was what I wanted to talk to Jordan Peterson about, is precisely the contradiction between his, say, free market absolutism and his commitment to free speech and, on the one hand, and on the other hand, his love of customs and archetypes and spiritual wisdom as the principles that should formulate society, that those two things, that you can't really have both. I mean, people do, but there's an inconsistency there.
Okay. I see. I think that's very well put. Very interesting. So free speech is a kind of, I mean, it's interesting because we were talking about capitalism earlier and the subversive, forces of it. So there's, you know, so that's a kind of economic liberty. And then if we're going to talk about, speech liberty, we also have the disruptive or, kind of subversive implications of that for what? The terrain of restraint on the way in which we talk about things, which has been handed to us by custom for a good and sufficient reason. The taboos around, for example, the race discourse that are that make a guy like Charles Murray into a pariah. You must be aware that Ezra Klein and Sam Harris had this big kind of debate about the coverage of the bell curve or whatever. So free speech, right? And I mean, I must say that, at the time the bell curve came out, I took the position of custom, which is to say, we can't talk this way about black people. In so many words. I mean, I was kind of anti-Murray. And in fact, I had known Murray because we overlapped at the American Enterprise Institute in the early 90s. And we're friendly, and I had known him before that because we overlapped at the Manhattan Institute in the 80s when his book Losing Ground was hot. He was a fellow at the Manhattan Institute before he went to AEI, and he went to the AEI from Manhattan Institute because he took on this IQ project, and the Manhattan Institute thought it was over the line. So we went to AEI where he found a home. And I knew him, and I was expected to kind of, you know, if anybody was going to support him, I was expected to support him. And I'm sure they review me, the people who were, running the AEI at that time, view me as having, you know, betrayed them at some level because I had to go anti-Murray, and it was, maybe it was an identity move as much as it was a cognitive move. But anyway, we have this taboo, right? Because these test scores are these huge differences in cognitive functioning, this, you know, a big racial gap. Heritability is another question. But, how you talk about that? How you, you know, and is that taboo a customary inheritance that we need to nurture rather than overturn in this kind of, exercise of my free speech? You know, I'm going to just open up Pandora's box or whatever the metaphor is here, of loosing into the world all of these things that custom had heretofore restrained.
Well, you hit upon one that's, you know, that's clearly a live issue, unfortunately, actually, today. How do you even begin to start talking about that issue without violating custom to the extent that reason is no longer possible? I would say that, I mean, I would say that my move would maybe be just to say, why are we asking this question? Is this even the right starting question? What are the assumptions we have here?
I made that move too.
Yeah.
Excuse me for interrupting, Doug, but that's where I usually end up. I usually end up at a meta level of, you know, there's so many things we could be talking about. Why are we talking about this? Not that it's not a factual question or that at some level people shouldn't be free to investigate facts as may bear on it, but that it's not a useful expenditure of our time.
Right. And I hold with that. But the other thing that I would say is that one reason why people do want to raise that issue is because they have a political agenda, and it's not even necessarily a straightforwardly ideologically racist political agenda, although it can be, but it can also just be a way to, justify or cement or explain away lack of social mobility amongst the underclass or the working class. And that certainly is what Charles Murray does. And he doesn't just do it around race. He does it around class as well. His new book has been about limiting himself to the white working class and claiming that the reason, you know, people end up in the working class is because they're cognitively underdeveloped or, you know, at a disadvantage or what have you. And I don't buy it. I don't buy it about working people. I don't buy it about anybody. I think we have more capacity than we know, and I don't think the IQ test is necessarily the limits to how we should understand human cognition or the ability for humans to learn.
Okay, so let's push this since we're talking about this. I don't want to talk about IQ. I want to talk about violence. Okay, I'm homicide. There's huge racial disparities. There's huge class variation, I'm sure. I haven't looked into that. But we all know about the racial disparity. More than half the homicides are committed by like 5% of the population. Some crazy number like that. Order of magnitude higher if you're a young black man or whatever. Now, I don't know this true, and I'm not hypothesizing it. I'm not saying it's true. Could there be something? And it doesn't have to be genetic, but it could be. In the endocrinological systems that govern from the pituitary to the thyroid to the adrenal, that varies in ways which, when interacted with certain social conditions like stress, maternal stress, I don't know. I'm making this up.
Right.
I'm not saying it's true. It could be true. Something like this could be true.
Sure. Let's not say it's about black people, but about the Irish, who I'm more willing to say that it might be the Irish are this way. But
okay, I mean, I'm not trying to say anything intrinsic to anybody, please. Right, but it could be intrinsic for all. I mean, I'm not ruling that out. Do I have to rule out? So I'm trying to make this epistemic point because I'm saying the ability to actually change it. I wear corrective lenses. My vision with the lenses is 20/20. The ability to intervene so as to make the outcome different depends upon understanding the mechanisms that are at play, which could include biogenetic mechanisms that account for variation at the level of what we understand to be racial groups. You cannot a priori rule that out. Now, to me, that is a dilemma. That's like a profound, you know, it's up there with, should the atomic physicist loosen to the world the knowledge about how to make nuclear weapons or something like that? I mean, it's like, I don't want to get on a high horse and pronounce, you know, about free speech or anything else. It seems to me to be a very deep social dilemma, but it's not one-sided. It's not obvious. It's not straightforward.
Yeah. I would just say that, certainly you want to know why something is happening if you want to correct it or change it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's just obvious. But so what bothers me about the questions around IQ is that they're asked not in the spirit of trying to address the problem, but to try to justify the problem. You know, to naturalize the situation. To the extent that they
that almost feels like an non sequitur now, Doug, because if indeed the answers to the questions are the things that are relevant to intervening and doing something, what does it matter what the motive is of the person who asked the question? What matters is whether or not the answer is this or that.
Well, see, some of these look, I live in the real world. Some of my actual thoughts on this are if it's true that some group of people are cognitively disadvantaged. And, first of all, I don't think that we want to live in a world in which people who are less smart are going to starve. So, you know, a socialist society would be one in which those people wouldn't have that problem. But the other thing is, if those people wanted to get to do things in the world that required more cognition or, you know, higher intelligence, I think that we should be able to give people glasses.
Charlie.
Yeah.
Can you keep a secret?
Yeah.
I'm a good secret keeper.
That mouse you raised today.
Yeah, that Algeron.
He was very special. He had an operation. When it was over, he was smarter. The doctors are ready to try that operation on a man. They're ready to choose someone now. That's why you had all those tests.
Well, they should have told me. I would have tried harder.
Do you like an operation like that?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I like to be smarter so that I could understand Gimpy and the fellas at the bakery. Because a lot of the words I don't understand. And I, just so I could get a little closer, you know.
I think we can get you to raise Algernon again.
I don't know. And Algernon's a smart little mouse.
Mr. Gordon, how do you feel at the present moment about your development?
Grateful, sir.
You are happy about it?
Yes, sir.
Why?
Because it has allowed me to see.
To see what?
The world.
And what do you see in that world?
Well, my eyes are new, Doctor.
And what do they see, Mr. Gordon?
Things as they are.
And
what they are becoming.
Can you give me an example, Mr. Gordon?
No, sir, you give me one.
Very well.
Very well.
Modern science.
Rampant technology. Conscience by computer.
Modern art.
Dispassionate draftsman.
Foreign policy.
Brave new weapons.
Today's youth.
Joyless, guideless.
Today's religion.
Breachment by popularity poll.
Standard of living.
A TV in every room.
Education.
A TV in every room.
The world's future, Mr. Gordon.
Brave new hates, brave new bombs, brave new wars.
The coming generation.
Test tube conception, laboratory birth, TV education, brave new dreams, brave new hates, brave new wars, a beautifully purposeless process of society suicide. Any more questions? In the back, any more questions about things as they are and what they're becoming? No?
That's not the politically correct answer.
That sounds close to disability almost. I mean, it.
Well, you know, but that's what education is anyway, right? It's
at what cost, the economist wants to say.
Oh, at what cost do we give people the power to get glasses?
For example, landing in a 747 aircraft. Okay, that requires certain abilities. I don't know exactly what they are, but I can imagine what they might be. Not just intelligence. I'm talking about, you know, your vision. I'm talking about your hand-eye coordinate, whatever. I don't know what it takes. But I assume that not everybody can do it. Not just training. Some people would flunk out of the training, whatever that is, or landing a jet fighter on an aircraft carrier. So everybody can't be allowed to do that in some compensatory way such that we don't reckon with the so now what about brainstorming the solution to a coding problem to try to develop a new product that's going to affect billions of people? Not everybody can do that either. Pardon me? What about building a bridge and mastering the craft of being able to know whether or not it's going to fall down? That's a rarefied skill. So how can I poo-poo if there are variations in human populations. First of all, in the functioning capacity of people to undertake these various tasks, I mean, I'm saying it could be acquired. It doesn't have to be intrinsic. But then more fundamentally, in the substratum of what their endowment is, what their human capacities are. You don't think they vary across individuals? They vary along every other dimension. Human performance, they probably vary along the dimension of intellectual performance. I'm going to hold everyone harmless for that, such that nobody has any advantages. That seems to be a utopian notion. What about physical traits? What about emotional capacity? What about leadership or oratory skill and whatnot? I'm going to keep people from commanding power over other people in the world based upon variation in human capacities. It's a fool's errand.
Enterprise. I didn't go so far as to say that everyone had to have, you know, the exact same abilities. I said that if people are wanting to do things in the world that require higher cognition, and we should develop technologies to give people the freedom to improve. That should be a social goal. I'm not saying that. But the main thing is like why is it the case that, you know, what is the pressure on people to fit into a certain kind of terrain? Like, for instance, what is the pressure on women to get into STEM? Why is that considered a political battle? It's not because, I don't think it's because women have a love of science that goes beyond what is normal for anybody. I think it's because that's a realm of power in society. That's where you get high incomes, and also you have a lot of influence on what's developed and what the future will be. So that's a contested space, and women want into it more because it's a center of power. So when you're talking about socialism, you're talking about shifting how power is distributed and changing what the basis of it is. And so I'm not saying that like means once I say those magic words that I've solved the problem, but you'd have to start to think about what a more equitable society, one that isn't based on class relations the same way as this one is, would look like.
Let's take the women in STEM, because that James Damore, you were talking about the intellectual dark web. Isn't he somehow in that mix too? Somehow? I think I've seen his name somewhere in that connection. This is the Google employee who was let go after after a memo that he had written that offered some thoughts about the reasons for the disparity. And what I want to say is, so there are two master narratives. One of them is that is in the spirit of Damore, men and women are different in ways large and small, which in some constellation account for the different incidents of their presence in certain tasks and activities in that corporation and in that industry. That's one account. Another account is that a priori we assume that men and women are not different. I make these in very stark terms. They can be, you know, they can obviously be qualified. A priori, we assume that men and women aren't different. And we infer from that the disparity in the incidence of their, you know, participation in this or that activity must in some way or another reflect the abuse of power. It's both a normative and a causal position. Okay? It asserts that the disparity has come about because of some actions other than can be justified in some meritorious and, you know, neutral and normatively acceptable, account. There's been exploitation. There's been abuse. And, those narratives are in keen competition with one another. And I don't know that we know which one is true. I mean, I know that there's a correct, a politically correct position about it. I think that's another thing that Jordan Peterson does. I remember these chapters when he's talking about some of these gender issues and 12 rules. And he is not drinking the Kool-Aid on the supposition that there are no gender differences that are of relevance to any outcomes of social significance that we might observe, and the supposition that any such disparities must represent exploitation and abuse into some kind of patriarchal domination narrative.
Even radical feminists from the 70s, like some of the most outlandish and crazy radical feminists from the 70s, would agree that there are innate biological differences between men and women. We just published a book on a feminist named Shumalith Firestone, who wanted to eliminate childbirth through a technological intervention in order to give women more social equality. So wow. She's, yeah, you know, so she was looking for test tube babies to be the future of how, you know, people come to be. And the questions there are profound. Now, as a science fiction writer, I love it. But as a legitimate, you know, social goal, I'm not so sure. But like, for instance, what would happen?
I take comfort in that.
Right. You know, what would happen to a lot of what we by custom and what I think might be have a lot of merit actually cherish about being human is involved in sexual reproduction. I would hate to live in a world where, along with childbirth, sex had been eliminated. There's, you know, it rings of 1984 to me. But,
okay. And yet we do, allow children to remain with their very class, differentiated parents, and enjoy unequal access to the fruits of modern, civilization and culture, on that basis. I mean, we don't take children away from their parents. You know, test tube is a way of the woman foregoing the childbirth experience and putting men and women somehow on a more egalitarian footing in that respect. But the next generation's inequality is nurtured in the intimacy of private association, which is only one way of arranging how you pass on from one generation to next our cultural inheritance.
Right. In other words, who's going to raise these test tube babies and how are they going to be raised? It would be
or even without the test tube, who's raising the babies that are actually being birthed within our society? And couldn't they be being raised differently? So that if I'm a radical, which question am I asking? The absolutely sort of throwing over everything that we've gotten question about gender, or somehow the much more doable, you might even think, and maybe more immediate questions about class differences.
I've been reading Christopher Lash recently. I just started the True and Only Haven book, and I read The Culture of Narcissism, and there's another one that I started. And what I would say is that, you know, he was a socialist of a type, and he went through certainly a Marxist period. I don't know to the extent that he stayed with Marxism, but he had a very strong critique of the new left and of the established left politically, the actual political left in the United States in the 70s and 80s, saying that they basically had the wrong view on the family and that they wanted to replace family structures and traditions around the family with state intervention, which had a terrible effect, especially on the working class. That the idea that, you know, some bureaucrat is going to understand better how to raise a kid that they don't really care about, than his own family was a kind of a liberal shibboleth that needed to be overturned. We go pretty deep about how this idea of the state as a replacement for custom and tradition had this effect on the working class and put the left at odds with what was supposed to be its own base of support. So all of that is, I think, open. I mean, I haven't come to real conclusions about how to address Lash's critique of the left, but I think it's like a serious critique that leftists ought to take on board and try to deal with. My problem with the intellectual dark web is that it is cementing the division and cementing the way people can address these issues rather than breaking them down. That it seems it pretends to be a thoroughgoing critique, but it doesn't even take up someone like Christopher Lash, as far as I can see. It doesn't look enough to the left to even understand why the left is in the position that it is. It just kind of dismisses the entirety of anything from, I don't know, anything from Hillary Clinton to the left, maybe, as being the enemy, as being postmodern weirdo bad people.
So I want to, this last observation you're making stimulates me, and I want to ask you a question, which is, so I've got ghetto poverty, whatever we mean by that. I got housing projects. I got tenement districts of concentrated low income, jobless, high crime, dilapidated building, you know, a high eviction rate, gangs, drug selling, lawlessness. I got high homicide rates amongst teenage black and Latino kids in Chicago or whatever it is. I got multi-generational welfare dependency or whatever I've got. OK, and I want to change it. I want universal pre-K. I want a longer school day, a longer school year, depending on what reformer you talk to. I've got a different policy. I want summer camps. I want counselors. What am I trying to do? I focus on the younger generation. I got a triage strategy. If they're 17 or they're 12, it's already too late, whatever. What am I trying to do? I'm trying to alter the patterns of socialization of young people as they mature into their adulthood, who have certain particular class locations, which class locations come along with certain patterns of behavior, certain expectations in the social networks in which people are naturally embedded, certain values, attitudes, and beliefs, certain practices and routines, and customs and norms. And I want to break that down because I don't want to reproduce the poverty. I don't want the little girl to be pregnant at 16 the way her mother was pregnant at 16. I want the kid to stay in school and to stay in the dead end, not dead end, but minimum wage job rather than go hustling and being on the street corner, whatever. I want him to go to church or something. I want him to be different than what they would have been if I hadn't intervened. So where does the question has to do with where does one get this supposition that the natural state of nature has a claim on us. In this case, the state of nature that I'm referring to is the conjunction of certain cultural norms, practices, routines, expectations, and beliefs with certain class location. Okay? And it becomes a betrayal of the class to want to countervene those norms, customs, practices, beliefs, and patterns, which might be, in a way, reinforcing the marginalization of the particular people. And I'm not just talking about the fact that you work for a wage rather than owning the means of production. I'm talking about the fact that you are a so-called underclass, that you are a backwater margin, that your homicide rate is 10 times higher and you're half the people in prison when you're only 5% of the population. Things like that.
Well, I'm not against those interventions. It's funny. Your question or the where you went was not exactly where I expected you to go. I kind of expected you to be very critical of those state interventions into people's lives, but you were, in the end, an advocate for the.
Well, I don't know that there's any other way that I'm a reluctant advocate for this. Brings me back to the black nationalism thing in a way, because I think it's also, I don't think there's any other way than a kind of diminishment of the ethnic emphasis and an embrace of the national project, the American project. I circle back to some ideas that we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation.
There are other approaches to how to deal with the dysfunction of communities and society, and other than trying to save the kids. I mean, the first question I would ask is, if you want to know, if before you go in and intervene in these ways, you should ask yourself, to what extent did these kids' parents also get subjected to similar interventions? What has the effect been so far? You hear stories about people intervening in kids' lives and really changing the direction of their lives. And I think it happens a lot, but it doesn't happen because it happens when people actually care about individuals and have a real connection to them and take on a leadership role that takes some sacrifice to them personally. It doesn't happen when a professional class comes in and implements technocratic solutions. I mean, technocratic solutions are great when you're talking about someone's physical health in an emergency situation in the hospital. They're not so great when you're talking about someone's social and political, psychological state in their everyday life. And I just don't think that those kinds of interventions go far enough. I think that probably better than worrying about, probably better than relying on those kinds of interventions, because some of them might be helpful, like summer camps and resources and things like that. But how about trying to help the family, help the father find work and the mother find work, or maybe not, you know, that kind of thing. That would be my kind of knee jerk reaction, but I'm not an expert. I'm not one of your usual blogging heads, you know, political class kind of people who's had any experience.
Sell short, Doug. Yeah. I was just thinking that, you're privileging the family now, which is another level of, you know, don't take the kids away, be more holistic. And I suppose one could generalize that and say not just a family, but a community at some level. Or then you could generalize that and talk about racial groups. And, you know, there would be different consequences of putting the
I don't want to be forced back into embracing some sort of racial politics because I wanted to help the family, you know, get on its feet.
You're right.
But I think this is a really interesting and really fruitful conversation. And the last question I have for you, is just, do you think, you've been attracted to the intellectual dark web. Do you think that these kinds of conversations that would include someone as crazy as me, a socialist, a real, you know, a leftist, could happen, with this group of people, with people like Brett Weinstein and Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson? Or do you think, like I do, that really this is a right-wing brand, for a kind of halfway measure into free speech? And I want to add one other thing is, are you aware that Brett Weinstein and has been testifying to Congress about college campuses and free speech in such a way that it seems to me to be leading up to legislation to limit protest on college campuses? That sort of.
No, I'm not aware of that. And that's not uninteresting to me. That's interesting to me. And I'm not surprised exactly at it, just based on his Evergreen State experience.
Yeah.
And he did go on Tucker Carlson at the time that stuff was going on. And, he and his wife, Heather, what's her last name?
I don't remember her. Yeah.
Something like that.
I get her confused with the woman who died in Charlottesville, Heather Heyer, but that's not who it is.
Oh yeah. I can see why you would.
Yeah.
Testifying before Congress, that's so political. It's a Republican Congress and the culture wars strike again. And, it looks like, evidently Brett has taken sides. Do I think the intellectual dark web, the IDW, more generally right wing, Sam Harris, Joe Rogan, Jordan Peterson, Rubin, I don't know. I mean, if to the extent that Lowry would be, you know, somehow, considered in the same, orbit, I'd like to think not. I'd like to think that, I mean, I think people are going to disagree with this. I do admit to a certain conservatism. I think that, you know, there ought to be a distinction between that and being a right winger. I would hope it wouldn't be pejorative to be conservative. I think that's a defensible philosophical position, custom versus reason and all of that. Right wing, no. And you're kind of giving a more sophisticated gloss on what I think is a very dangerous and wrongheaded dismissal of free speech claims. I saw a bumper sticker wrapped around a telephone pole here on the Brown's campus. Free speech equals violence. Well, because they're saying you're weaponizing free speech on behalf of an agenda of, you know, patriarchal, heteronormative, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Look, here's what I think. I think that, success of the American Revolution and the founding of the country and the legal order in which we're embedded, in which these questions arise, it's a constitutional order. This is late 18th century. This is kind of like taking these ideas out of Enlightenment and whatnot and instantiating them in institutions of government. And we still are very much largely under the sway of that. It's a particular historical moment. And I think there's, I'm not going to call it transcendent value, but I want to juxtapose my reliance upon a constitutional order in which people would be endowed with certain liberties, including the liberties to conduct arguments contrary to, for example, think that Columbus was a great guy, that the discovery, to think that the importation of the African slaves actually led, after some generations and much travail, to a vastly improved quality of life for their descendants than would have been in the most likely counterfactual had they never been imported in the first place. I hope anybody who hears me say that doesn't immediately assume that I actually believe these things. The point of even using such extreme examples as the progenitor of a genocide being elevated to a hero, or African Americans being invited to be thankful for the enslavement of the ancestors, I don't believe either one of those things. The point of raising such extreme examples is precisely to test the principle. Okay? Now, a committee, even an informal one, telling me that those thoughts can't be uttered by Dinesh D'Souza or Milo Yiannopoulos. Okay? And is going to decide to use force to prevent the expression of those thoughts? Man, that is so far over the line. I'm not going into the fairy tale Neverland of parsing such cases. That's way over the line. Charles Murray can't be spat upon. Okay? That simply cannot be allowed to happen. That's the mob rule. That's tyranny. Uh-huh. It's the undermining of the foundations of our political order. It's exactly that serious. Who do these people think they are? Because their feelings are hurt? They tell me what I can say about Columbus because their feelings are hurt? They tell me what I can and can't ask in terms of questions about race and IQ? They are inquisitors and they have power. Not a weaponization of free speech. Something really important is at stake.
I look at what you're talking about as a symptom of the dissolution of sort of the liberal established political class, that it's being felt on a lot of different levels. The fact that Hillary Clinton lost to a reality TV show host who should never have gotten the nomination in his party, by the way, either, is another demonstration of some sort of real profound political crisis. And it doesn't surprise me that we're having having problems around the issue of free speech. But all I would say is that it's two-sided. It's not just that there's a liberal establishment that's trying to suppress free speech, but that questions of what can be asked and what we will allow ourselves to consider and what kinds of presuppositions we want to cling to without question, you know, are running through all sorts of different parts of society, including the intellectual dark web. Otherwise, Brett Weinstein wouldn't be in front of the Congress trying to suppress speech, even as he claims to be advocating for it. And that would be my rejoinder to you. But I'm not with the students saying free speech is violence. And I'm not saying that the intellectual...
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to impute that belief to you. I just meant to say that belief is out there.
I know it is. Believe me. And it has been used against me. You know, I get attacked by the left all the time. On the regular, but I don't end up in front of Congress, and I don't think the left is the primary problem in society today. And I just think that the left is confused and needs, you know, needs more of me all the time.
You may be comforted, Douglas, to know that my wife agrees with you. My wife and I always often argue about politics and culture, because she's a leftist. I think I don't misdescribe her in saying so, although she might not ascribe to any particular, you know, Marxian or any other such systematic philosophy. She definitely leans left. And the idea that when I'm complaining about stuff that's going on the left, her constant refrain is, you know, well, they do it on the right too.
Right. Well, it's not, I agree with her about that, but I also would say, like, one step beyond that observation, which is there's got to be some other cause for it. If it's on both, it's not just a cultural problem.
I see.
You know, it's a political crisis. It's an economic crisis. We just had an economic crisis. We're having a political crisis. And the fact that we are culturally confused is not actually that surprising, considering all that. And I would really love to have something like an intellectual dark web that would include, you know, Marxists and leftists and anarchists and socialists of different stripes, rather than be, just on the conservative side. To have it, it pains me deeply to see the free speech position be fully taken up by the right and then used as a marketing technique, you know, by these guys.
I think that's pretty ironic because, you know, I'm an economist, right? I operate within an academic community in which a number of the, you know, fundamental precepts or orientations or whatever are challenged in Marxism. In ways that are definitely not, you know, self-evident. And, you know, the challenge should probably resonate. You know, you should probably be made to be thinking long and hard about the nature of the challenge. And yet that inclination, that sort of Marxist radical critical inclination, is kind of winnowed out. I mean, it doesn't have any standing. I mean, you look at the American Economics Association's annual meetings or whatever, you know, nobody's going to take that stuff seriously. You look at who's getting tenure in all the departments and what articles on the mastheads of the journals and stuff. And the questions don't get asked. The way of thinking doesn't get reflected and so on. There was this moment in, I think, the history of 20th century economics after the 60s where people, you think of Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis very famously, Union of Radical Political Economists. There was really an effort at radical political economy that took Marx very seriously and took critical theory very seriously, and tried to import that into some of the questions, especially in human resource economics and you know, inequality and whatnot, but also in the macroeconomics to a certain extent. I remember my classmate Sandy Darity happens to be African American. Trained at Brown in the London School of Economics before coming to MIT to get a PhD, and we overlap. And he rather fancied himself, you know, a radical. There was the Cambridge UK Cambridge US controversy about capital theory, which had kind of neo-Marxian stuff running around its undertones in it versus a kind of neoclassical capital theory. Anyway, that's all vanished from economics. It's none of it. There's not even a whimper. A person could say free speech. Well, then, whatever. To which the answer is going to be the community of scholars, has the ongoing conversation in which those matters emphasized are those that are thought to be of the most fertile for research purposes. And the reason we're not talking about it is because it doesn't have any relevant content for, the research questions that we want to address. And I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced by that, especially since I think those research questions should extend into the realm of normative theory and theory of value. Theory of value should mean something other than calculating, given people's preferences, what prices will emerge. It should be literally a theory about what it is that we, quote, should value, close quote, and how we persuade ourselves or create a community in which we are willing to affirm what ought to be a good life. That's what I'm, again, circling back, you know, saying about the climate change and environmentalism and whatnot. I think people are not sufficiently ambitious theoretically. I think the deepest questions about how we humans live on the planet, not about tittering around at the margin of the mechanisms used to produce the kind of civilization that we don't even subject to ethical scrutiny about.
This was really great conversation, I thought, and I would love to have you back.
Can I ask you something, Doug? Yeah. I wonder if you would. Can I post this at my podcast? Say it's you, but it's your thing, or do you have a proprietary thing? Or?
Oh no, you want to post it on Blogging Heads?
Yeah, if I could get a good file that I could pass on to my tech guy, I'd put it up at the Glenn Show. Sure.
Yeah, I'd be glad to have you put that up.